In this episode of Fictional Hangover, we talk about worms, maggots, tiny hats, and snapping too, Will Henry, in our discussion of The Monstromologist by Rick Yancey, narrated by Steve Boyer. Snap too, Will Henry! Hey everybody, welcome to Fictional Hangover, a podcast about young adult and new adult books, series, authors, and voice actors that is full of spoilers. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Claire, and today we're going to discuss The Monstromologist by Rick Yancey.
Standard disclaimer, if you haven't read this book, please remember that Fictional Hangover is all about spoilers. If you haven't read or listened and don't want to be spoiled, stop listening to us and go read or listen to the book. Then come back. If you haven't done this but want to pretend that you have, or if you don't care about spoilers, or if you just love the show so much that you don't care about any of that, then listen up. Woohoo!
Whoa, another
October
scary
October scary book. Number two.
Two scary books.
We are filling you with ghoulish delight.
And shall we two meet again?
Oh, yes, here we are. Getting ready to tell you a tale.
What? Yikes.
I have no idea. Yikes. What the heck went on?
I don't know.
And I don't even have my witch's hat on. Highly disappointed with myself.
Should be. Oh, there it is. I don't there have a witch's is. Hat today. I wasn't prepared. But I do have my orange twinkly lights.
Yes, I have my Bat and Witchy Pillar Candles next to the Sanderson Sisters Pops.
Excellent. See, I was planning on...
As is only right and proper.
I was planning on adding something new every week. Last week, I had the little fox friend, and he was sitting next to the book, but now he's up a little bit higher with the twinkly lights. I'm going to add something new every time, though.
Yeah, I need to bring my blown glass pumpkin up.
Next time.
Poosh.
Next time.
Yes. Yes, that will be emerging.
Yeah, we'll get progressively spookier every time.
I've got some fake webbing somewhere as well. Somewhere.
For the last one, I'm probably just going to cover everything in fake blood.
Including yourself.
Yeah.
Which won't be the first time.
No.
I mean, the first time for this apartment and new neighbours, but still.
It's fine.
It's all
fine.
Good.
It's fine.
It's all good.
Wow.
Anywho, The Monstromologist.
The Monstromologist.
Isn't it a tongue twister of a word?
I love it. I love everything about this book.
Okay, well, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
We are getting ahead of ourselves.
Let's dial it back a minute and a half.
Okay.
Have you got any fun facts, background info, something I do not expect?
Sure.
Something crawling from a grave, preferably.
Yes, getting sucked down into a grave. Something with too many teeth.
Worms everywhere.
Worms. Yeah.
If we can have some kind of parasitic infestation, bonus.
Later.
Cool.
So, from Scary Out There, a blog on horror in young adult fiction from June 2013, Jonathan Mayberry asked Rick Yancey, where'd the Monstromologist idea come from? And Rick Yancey said, the Monstromologist series evolved as I wrote it. My original concept was to write a Jaws-like story set in the 19th century, told epistolarily. I loved stories from that era, loved the style, loved that time when there were still dark places in the world and men who dared to delve into them. The story of the monster hunter and his apprentice grew in directions unforeseen, putting out roots and branching into places I hadn't anticipated. This, by the way, is one of the great joys of writing, when your characters take your original idea and do something totally unexpected and wonderful with it. Do you know what else I read? Which has not come to fruition, and I don't think that it is.
What?
In 2018, I believe, options were purchased, but I don't think it's going to happen. There hasn't been anything since then.
No.
But it would be so great.
It would. It would. I would like it to be picked up, like, done by somewhere like HBO, where it's not afraid to go with the gore and the nudity aspects and, you know. Yes. Not, I don't want this to be turned into a PG. It needs to be...
Now, especially with this monster that features in the first one, because they don't wear clothes.
Yeah.
They got dangly bits flopping around all over the place.
Well, all shapes and sizes.
We're really going to have to talk more about that later, though.
I don't think I'm going to be able to avoid not talking about it.
I just have thoughts and questions, and I wonder what you think about them. But anyway, not there yet.
No, but if you do searches for the Monstromologist, you do get things where, I don't know if it's like fan-made trailers and stuff like that, so you do see, and obviously there's book trailers out there as well, but there's more than just the one, so I think there's obviously some fan-made stuff out there too.
Yeah.
Visually, it would be stunning.
Yeah. Yeah, it really would be.
Especially if they didn't try and update it and have it as a 21st century and just had it as the Victorian era. That would be...
Yeah, it'd be fantastic. It would be really great.
It's a little bit Interview with a Vampire, isn't it?
It is. It is just a
Except
little
bit. I hope it doesn't have Christian Slater. Tom Cruise.
You're fine with Brad Pitt, though?
Oh, God, no. I'm not a Brad Pitt fan. I'm one of those rare females who was like, Brad Pitt, no, sorry. It's like I'm a bad Brit because I don't think David Beckham's hot. I'm sorry, just no.
How do you feel about Antonio Banderas?
Yeah, actually quite like the Antonio Banderas.
Okay. Anyway.
Are we going to have to do a Rate My Vampire?
We might have to.
I think we should. We should do a Rate My Vampire.
I think that we should. Let's put that on social media. Especially in our... Patreon only group.
Well, I think the Patreon only group gets to have first dibs at it.
I think so. If you're interested in joining our Patreon only group, please check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/fictionalhangover and select our bonus tier. All right. So this book's been out for a while, and I read it when it first came out. I was super into it when it first came out, and I'm still super into it. I haven't read it, though, for several years, so I had forgotten how much I loved it. Mm. So it was nice to read it again, and I'm glad that I got to force you to read it. Ah!
Forced is a bit hard. I know we've been meaning to do this since I joined the team, but we'd already had the October schedule planned, and it was like, what should we do for this October? A Monstromologist, obviously.
Please and thank you.
It doesn't fit in with the theme of the month for the book club, which is haunted house.
Yeah, well, we had a haunted story last week.
Oh yeah.
No, it wasn't a house though, it was a flat pack
somebody lived
store.
There
that's
somebody
true
lived there.
That's true, there was someone living in the Orsk store, so it counts.
And if anything, isn't the Orsk house everyone's house?
Yes.
Ooh, dear. Ooh. Ooh. Do you know what I found with the Monstromologist, getting back on topic and trying to be semi-professional?
What? That's not a thing.
No, throw that one out the window. Sorry, I had a moment of whimsy.
What is this?
It was a slow burn for me. I enjoyed it, but it was a slow burn. And then it was where it got really good when a certain character turned up, and I was like, yes, hello. But I kept thinking, I was distracted all the way through, because it felt like something else I've already read, or some things else I've already read, and it was like a mishmash amalgamation. Not to disrespect the Monstromologist, if anything, it was like an homage to that Victorian era and gothic novel. So it's a very good chance I've read it, like a gothic novel, or some kind of like older story, and it's taken some of those threads.
Yeah.
So it felt very familiar. Very familiar. But for the life of me, can I heck remember what? I will say I do get a lot of Frankenstein and Dracula themes in there. Yes. I mean, come on. You know, to me, we'll get into a bit more, but Will Henry was very much like the Igor or the Renfield type character.
Yeah, except for he was 12.
Except for he's 12. It's almost, I wouldn't have been surprised if it turned out that Walthrop was like Van Helsing.
Yeah. Well, I kind of thought that it was going to lean sort of that way at the end, especially the first time I read it. But then with that...
other revelation.
With that revelation, you think, oh, well, this is where this book is, this is where this series is going to go. It's not.
Yeah.
Surprise! Yeah. It's not.
Yeah. Cool.
So let's get into it.
Definitely.
After a few pages of old texts describing the science of monstromology, and then a terrible, headless, cannibalistic monster called an anthropophagus, we see Rick Yancey himself receiving a bundle of folios written by a recently deceased man named William James Henry, who claimed to have been born in 1876. Rick has taken the folios and transcribed them. The first three folios are included in this summary. Will Henry is 12 and living with and working for Dr. Pellinore Warthrop, a monstromologist. Will Henry's parents died in a fire, and the only thing he has left of them now that he lives with Dr. Warthrop is a tiny hat that is too small for his head, but he wears it anyway. In the middle of the night, a grave robber comes to the doctor with a terrible find. This is not the first time a frightening delivery has come in the middle of the night, but this one might be the worst.
The doctor pays the man for the delivery, they carry it down to the basement, and then the man takes his leave. In his basement, Dr. Walthrop and Will Henry examine the burden. It is the body of a teenage girl with a 25 to 30-year-old anthropophagus wrapped around her small frame. It seems to have choked to death on a strand of pearls while eating her corpse. Eesh. The anthropophagus has a shark-like mouth in its stomach, large black eyes on its shoulders, and of course, no head. This is not the worst discovery, though. Inside the girl's corpse is a baby anthropophagus, and it's alive.
Yikes!
Anthropophagi can mate, but females can't carry their children for obvious mouth-belly reasons. Biology, man, it's weird. So the males place the offspring in a safe place to grow until they eat their way out.
Fantastic!
This one is removed, put into a jar, and then euthanized.
That's a whole lot that just happened in a very small amount of time.
Anthropophagus. But easier to say anthropophagi. Why is that? Who knows?
Dr. Warthrop and Will Henry work for hours dissecting the anthropophagus, all throughout the night and into the next day. The doctor can work tirelessly like this for extended periods, then will fall into a depression for weeks, only to be jolted out by some other terrible thing and start all over again. Will Henry, though, cannot, despite being told over and over again to snap to Will Henry by Dr. Warthrop. When they finish their gruesome work, he falls asleep and the doctor carries him to his room and removes his little hat. This causes Will Henry to wake up and burst into tears, thinking of his parents and how his father loved the doctor so much and how he would fight with his mother about him. He was always off with the doctor and would not, could not tell his wife or son where he went. But they died in a fire and are gone now, and Will Henry and the doctor only have each other.
After a short sleep, Will Henry is awakened by the doctor.
Snap to, Will Henry!
And tasked with gathering supplies. It seems they are going to the graveyard. Dr. Walthrop has determined that, while normally anthropophagi are pack creatures with one alpha male and 20 or so breeding females and offspring, that can't possibly be the case here because they are not native to the area and there haven't been other attacks. This has to be a new group that got here. Somehow. And now they must hunt the others. The grave robber, Erasmus Gray, arrives. They load up the supplies and the corpse in his cart and head to the cemetery. They go to the girl's grave, Dr. Walthrop, searching all around in the ground for disturbed earth, but find none. Will Henry and Erasmus Gray begin to dig up the grave again when they hear a hissing. They look all around, see no monsters. Then, from below in the grave, Erasmus is pulled down into the open maw of an anthropophagus. Will Henry and the doctor escape, just barely, without Will's Henry's hat. Oh, the little hat. After the doctor shoots Erasmus in the head. Yeah, they take the man's horse, having lost the cart, and tossing the girl's corpse as a distraction for the hungry beasts that are chasing them. There were many more than the doctor imagined. You can just see the ground exploding with,
yes,
you know, beasties. Can't.
Yes. Will Henry is shaken. He asks the doctor if he should contact the constable, thinking they should get a mob with pitchforks to go back and fight the monsters. But no. Instead,
that's what a true Victorian would do.
Right? Instead of doing any of that, Dr. Warthrop is studying books and maps, trying to figure out where the anthropophagi came from. Is that really important right now?
Research for science!
Snap to, Will Henry!
Apparently, it is important. Dr. Warthrop is convinced that they won't come back to feed for a week or so anyway, according to all the books he's read, and that's a lot. Will Henry is still upset, mostly by the death of Erasmus Gray, and the doctor is flummoxed as to why he should care so much about the death of an old man. After all, if he hadn't shot him in the head, Will Henry would also be dead, and he is indispensable to the doctor. Will Henry's father wouldn't be questioning him so much. Now snap to, Will Henry! There's much to be done.
Dr. Walthrop dictates a letter to the Monstromology Society, which Will Henry takes down about the discovery of the anthropophagi. Another letter is written soon after to John Jack Cairns, asking him to come to New Jerusalem at once to help with this new, angrier species of anthropophagi. Then he continues poring over his maps and newspapers until he finds what he's looking for. Dedham. He sends Will Henry down to the basement for his father's trunk. In it is a shrunken head, some human-born rune stones, books and papers, and one journal. The journal mentions Dedham and someone called V, who apparently was imprisoned for something involving Dr. Walthrop's father. All of this means something significant about the anthropophagi to Dr. Walthrop, so they plan to set off that evening for the small town.
Will Henry goes to mail the letters, and when he returns, he cannot find the doctor. He does find an article about the mysterious V, which the doctor had also found. The article says that Captain Varner was sailing from Africa back to America for the Confederacy when he was attacked on his ship by unearthly creatures. His abandoned ship was lost at sea for a while, and everyone on the ship died. He was convicted of dereliction of duty and deemed to be not of sound mind and confined to a private asylum in Dedham. Dr. Warthrop returns, he was at the cemetery, and tasks Will Henry with putting away the trunk and burning Erasmus Gray's hat, a scrap of dress he brought back from the grave, and his father's journal. He clearly wants to destroy all evidence of his involvement with this whole event. Snap to, Will Henry! Will Henry snaps to and does those things, but finds many letters a young Pellinore wrote to his father that were never opened. So, he reads one. Young Pellinore was in London for school, and he was sad and lonely. This is probably why the Dr. Warthrop now treats Will Henry the way he does. It's what he learned from his own father, after all. Tossing the rest of the items back into the trunk, he dislodges a key that was shoved into the tiny shrunken head and puts it in his pocket.
They arrive at the sanatorium late at night. After some gold coins are given to Dr. Starr, the elderly physician, who must be atrocious as he requires bribes to see his patients, they are allowed to see Captain Varner. His room smells strongly of bleach-covered rot. Mm. It's just, breathe it in, breathe it in, breathe it in. He tells the gruesome tale of bringing the anthropophagi from Africa to Pellinore's father. He requested four, an adult male and female, and two offspring, but Varner was only gifted three from the king, the largest and most aggressive female, one male, and one offspring. He also offered slaves to feed them on the journey back across the sea, but the senior Walthrop insisted they only eat livestock. The crew reinforced the area where the monsters would be held and tortured them. They would not eat the livestock, but they did eat their young.
Yikes!
Member of the crew thought it would be a good idea to dangle cut-up carcass into their cage, which allowed the female to jump and reach the man's arm, ripping it off, breaking through the cage and pulling him in to be feasted upon. That man is an idiot and got what he deserved.
Yeah, really. He really did.
And now, guess what?
What?
They're free!
Oh, fantastic.
Everyone on the ship died, apart from the captain, who managed to escape the female's maw when she bit down on his boot. He stabbed her in the eye with a knife and took off for the lifeboats. Somehow, it seems that two anthropophagi survived, and now, 23 years later, there are at least 30 of them.
Uh-oh.
Well, damn.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Will Henry was relieved at the end of the tale, for surely this means they can leave the foul room filled with buzzing flies. But no. The doctor also noticed the flies. Where could they be coming from? He goes to Varner's side and lifts the man's blankets. His naked, obese body is covered in rotting, maggoty bed sores. The staff had tried to cover up their neglect with fresh bandages and sheets, but as Dr. Warthrop continues his examination and pulls back the bedclothes, he uncovers the captain's feet, clad in the boots that once saved his life. Hoping to examine his feet, he struggles to pull off a boot. The captain shouts for him to stop, but the doctor continues. As the boot finally pulls free, the captain's foot comes off as well.
Blah.
Blah. Blah. The infection from his bed sores has wormed its way into his bones. Dr. Warthrop decides he has only hours to live. He asks what he can do to help the man. His reply? To kill him. Dr. Warthrop sends Will Henry out into the hallway to wait. There, he is repeatedly harassed by another prisoner of the sanatorium, calling for him to let him out, saying that he knows he's there. He can smell him. Dr. Warthrop doesn't end up killing the captain, but he does stay with him until he dies. They leave, Dr. Warthrop threatening the nurse with the constable, saying he's going to have the place shut down, and he hopes that she will be treated with the same kindness she showed her patients. Yikes, that sanatorium. No, thank you very much.
No, wouldn't put your worst enemy in there.
No. The creepy guy in the hallway was the worst, I think. Well, pulling off a foot boot is also pretty bad. But the guy in the
hallway. The two different things, though. One of them's grisly to look at, and one of them's just freaky as.
Will Henry's only 12, man.
He is scarred. That boy is scarred.
Yeah.
So the next day, Will Henry goes to the market. He talks to the shop's owners, which Dr. Walthrop always told him not to do, and they think the doctor's father worked with the Pinkertons and was a traitor to the United States. Will Henry shares this information with the doctor when he returns and suggests that maybe his dad brought the anthropophagi to New England for the Pinkertons to build an army. Walthrop, of course, thinks this is preposterous. He yells at Will Henry and says his father would never have questioned him in such a way. Will Henry yells back that he hates Dr. Walthrop and never wanted any of this life, and it's all his fault that his parents are dead.
It's after true. The fight, it's true, Will Henry. It's true.
Terrible cough you got there.
I know. Sorry. Sorry.
After their fight, Will Henry storms off to his room. Later, because his services are indispensable to him, he takes Walthrop a scone when he's in bed. Dr. Walthrop pretends nothing happened between them and wants Will Henry to stay by his bedside, but not really, but really he does. Yeah. Will Henry asks about his little hat, but the doctor didn't even know about his little hat, nor did he find any little hats at the cemetery. Will Henry is sad. That's the only thing he had left from his parents. He also gets a bad feeling about what is to come. Justifiable bad feelings.
Yes.
In fact, those feelings probably aren't strong enough.
Ugh. I just still really feel bad about his little hat. He really loves his
little hat. Just imagine this tiny little comical size hat.
I know.
Just perched on the top of his head.
His tiny little hat. He needs it.
Yeah.
Okay. So, his bad feeling was accurate, of course. A pack of 8 to 10 anthropophagi slaughtered a family overnight. The constable arrived with the bad news, and they traveled to the rectory near the cemetery. The reverend's entire family, except for one son, Malachi, who was able to escape, were devoured. Their blood and viscera and body parts were strewn all over the house. Dr. Worthrop, Will Henry, and the constable go to the church to talk to Malachi, but he feels exceptional survivor's guilt and doesn't say much, except to Will Henry. They talk of losing their families and how they both had to run, and finally, Malachi is able to describe what happened. It was awful, and it turns out the matriarch anthropophagus, the one Varner stabbed in the eye, led the attack. The constable takes Malachi in and gathers the mob with the pitchforks.
Yay!
The doctor claims this is unnecessary and will have nothing to do with it. The constable is inciting panic. Afterward, Dr. Worthrop, talking to Will Henry, explains that this is not his responsibility. He has no blood on his hands. Clearly he does, but he made the most scientific decisions he could, so he should not be held responsible for these deaths and the many that will come from the pitchfork mob.
I go fashion pitchfork mob.
Yeah. Yeah, I like a pitchfork mob.
Old school justice.
Yeah. I mean, okay. So the next wait, day. I need to just come clean. There's no mention of pitchforks in the book. I added the pitchfork in myself.
No, it's a good imagery. You get the feel. It's a little bit Beauty and the Beast when they're like, yeah. Gaston riles them all up.
Yeah.
Except in this instance, the constable really isn't that, you know, charismatic.
No. Mm-mm.
He's a bit of a douche, actually.
Yeah, he is. Anywho. He really is.
So the next day, the constable... The next day, the constable comes back with Will Henry's little hat. Yay!
Yay, Will Henry's little hat.
He has now deduced that Dr. Worthrop has known about the creatures all along and thus is responsible for them being there in the first place.
That's a big leap.
It is. Malachi is also there and one of the constable's men. Malachi takes a revolver from that officer and threatens to kill the doctor. Will Henry to the rescue again?
Snap to Will Henry!
He is able to talk Malachi down and takes him to a spare room to rest. Dr. Worthrop shows the constable the anthropophagus corpse in the basement.
That's what you want to see.
While they're down there. Yeah, exactly. Come to my basement and see my monster. While they're down there, there is a knock at the door. Jack Kearns has arrived with several boxes of supplies and gives the constable a false name when they are introduced, which leads to a silly bit where he's called by approximately 30 different names, and it's just friggin' delightful.
So great. So great. It's one of the best scenes in the entire book.
It really is. That scene, I was like, I'm there. This is when I came in. So he accuses Dr. Walthrop's father of bringing the anthropophagi there, which obviously he did. Now they have to take care of the situation. Earlier, around the Pinkerton mention, Dr. Worthrop had said yes, his father probably did bring the monsters to New Jerusalem. But surely it was to study them and to breed out their rage. Yeah, you talk to yourself, mate. Whatever he was going to do, this can't have been what was supposed to happen. They make a plan to gather the best sharpshooters and hunt the beasts.
At the cemetery later, Kearns sets up what he calls the slaughter ring.
I went to the slaughter ring. Ba-bum-bum!
With the help of several able-bodied men, the constable, the doctor, Will Henry, and Malachi, they set the trap. But of course, a trap needs bait. From one of his many supply boxes, Kearns pulls the body of a prostitute. He ties...
Just have one lying around.
She's got one. He ties her to a tree with a long rope, so she has plenty of room to run around because, yes, she's alive. Kearns stabs her and runs off to a platform they've constructed, and as the anthropophagi come out seeking their meal, he and the men get the beast's attention, draw them to the platform, surround them in a ring of fire, and begin to shoot them down. Dr. Worthrop runs to the woman with Will Henry and Malachi, and they're able to save her. While the two boys are with the woman, a straggler anthropophagus attacks them. But Will Henry, knowing the best ways to defeat the beasts, kills him. Good job, Will Henry.
Well, he snapped to it.
Snap to indeed.
After the slaughter of nearly all the estimated number of anthropophagi, they pile them up and burn them. While looking into the flames, Will Henry remembers his parents' death. James Henry had gone out on an expedition with Dr. Worthrop and returned with an illness that appeared to be shingles.
Mm-mm.
It was not shingles.
Nope.
No. Mm-mm. No. No, no, no. There were worms inside the sores on his body. He was full of them, like, completely riddled.
Mm. Overflowing.
Every time.
Overflowing with worms.
Literally.
Yeah.
In every sense of the word, overflowing with worms. Every time a sore would burst, including the ones on his tongue, worms would come out.
It's too many worms.
They were even in his tears.
It's too many worms.
He just went mad with the worms, and he reached into the fiery oven to stop the pain of them. Shortly thereafter, he was engulfed in flames. Will Henry opened the door to let the smoke out, which fueled the flames with fresh oxygen. And Will Henry's mother tried to put her husband out, but he grabbed her and held her close. She screamed for Will Henry to run, and he did, just as he told Malachi.
Yikes.
It was yikes. Just gross.
Yikes.
Just unnecessary. Like, one worm is too many? That was far, far, far too much.
Far too many worms. Screaming worms of fire. So, what to do about the rest of the anthropophagi? The one-eyed female and the handful of young that remain. What are we going to do with them? Why, we're going to go to them, of course. Kearns believes there is an entrance to their underground lair in the Worthrop Mausoleum. And he's right. Inside, behind a few puzzles, is a trap door. But it is locked. But oh-ho-ho, Will Henry has the key. It's the one he found inside the shrunken head that is still, conveniently enough, in his pocket. The trap door leads down a tunnel, and at the bottom, bones. Lots of bones.
Nice.
Yep. They surmise that the anthropophagi toss their prey down the hole and go down later to eat them. Seems reasonable.
Yeah, yeah.
Dr. Worthrop, Kearns, and Malachi drop down into the hole, but cannot go far into the tunnel below because they are too big.
Uh-oh.
So, down comes Will Henry. Snap to Will Henry! He slides through a tiny, claustrophobic passage that collapses under him, and then he falls into the anthropophagi's nest. In the nest is one severely injured anthropophagus. It's missing an arm, and its wound is infected. Does he kill it, or leave it alone?
Find out next week! Neither, for it attacks! Just as he was about to shoot, pulling back the hammer on the revolver, it awakens. Mm. They tussle and tumble down another path. Will Henry does his best to hold the beast's uninjured arm with his huge claws away, but in the fall, he accidentally lets go. That's all an anthropophagus needs. It attacks and bites Will Henry's arm.
Mm.
To get it to let go, he does the same thing and bites down on the anthropophagus's infected stump of an arm.
Mm.
Puss squirts into his mouth, and he wants to vomit.
Mm.
You are not the only one at this point, Will Henry. The anthropophagus lets go, and then Will Henry bashes it to death with a rock. 2 kills in one night.
Way to go, Will Henry. Way to go, Will Henry.
Yeah, superhero. He slowly makes his way back up through the tunnel. They tumble down and up another. Just as he's about to give up, thinking he's lost forever, he encounters Jack Kearns. Kearns sends him on, showing him a path to follow. He's left a phosphorus trail and tells Will Henry the exact way to go. Not to get out, as Will Henry was led to believe, but straight into the den of the mother anthropophagus. Wonderful.
So great.
Kearns follows behind Will Henry and pushes him out of a hole and down into the depths of the pit.
Two anthropophagi attack almost immediately. Kearns didn't really push Will Henry down there to die, but just to use as bait because he ran out of prostitutes. He shoots from above, killing one of the beasts, and Malachi kills the other. Because, ooh, yes, Malachi and Dr. Worthrop are also in the den. Dr. Worthrop comes to Will Henry's side, chastising him, but really, it's done with love. Don't you know how you are indispensable to me? If that's not fatherly concern, nothing is. You're indispensable to me, Will Henry. Dr. Kearns elegantly leaps from above, and he and Dr. Worthrop follow footprints down a tunnel near an underground river while Malachi and Will Henry stay behind. They hear a gunshot, and then Malachi is sucked through the river-soaked floor by the mother beast herself. It's just like with Erasmus Gray, but Malachi doesn't want to be saved. He takes a grenade from a pack made for him by Kearns, holds it tightly, and pulls the pin as he is dragged down to the monster by the handle she made from his spinal column.
After the explosion, the anthropophagus leaps from the hole, charging for Will Henry. He only has one bullet left in his revolver, so makes a desperate attempt to stop her attack. He grabs one of the corpses from a few moments ago and holds the gun to it. She stops, makes a warbling call, and when it's not returned, she attacks. Will Henry knows he has only one shot, so he waits. She gets closer. Still he waits. Closer. Closer. He pulls the trigger.
A month later, Will Henry and Dr. Worthrop are back in their house, having a relatively normal day. Dr. Worthrop asks if there has been any news. No. News of what, though? Shortly after the events of the anthropophagi affair, as they came to call it, Dr. Worthrop, Will Henry, and John Jack Kearns, though this time he calls himself Dr. John J.J. Schmidt, go back to the sanatorium. They talk to Dr. Starr about what has happened, about Dr. Worthrop's father, the Pinkertons, and they finally get the truth. The elder Worthrop was assisting the Pinkerton men with a eugenics experiment to equal Nietzsche's Übermensch. We know the Übermensch! Check out...
Yes!
Check out the Diviners podcast for more of that one. They wanted to breed the anthropophagi with humans to create beings with the power of the anthropophagi and the brains of Homo sapiens. This did not go as planned.
To be fair, it's not a really good plan in the first place. No.
Every person supplied by Dr. Starr from the sanatorium for mating was devoured. So then the elder Worthrop decided to keep them alive and keep feeding them with donations from Dr. Starr, sure that he could tame them. Worthrop paid for the deliveries even after his death, but when the payments finally stopped, Dr. Starr stopped sending deliveries. And that's when they started erupting from the graveyard and eating corpses. Kearns breaks Dr. Starr's neck after this revelation, and they leave. Kearns leaves the doctor's house later that night and disappears for a while, presumably to avoid being arrested for murder. However, something did come up in one newspaper. a mention of Jack the Ripper. Coincidentally, Jack Kearns mentioned being from Whitehall, the same town as the Ripper. And thus, we can only conclude that he is Jack the Ripper. Makes sense. He's got spare prostitutes.
He knows anatomy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great.
Before leaving for the sanatorium, the doctor had checked on Will Henry's wounds, which appear to glow in the dark. Now he's examining him fully, drawing his blood and running tests. Tests that will have to be performed for the rest of his life. Seems that Will Henry is infected with the same worms his father had. But before we all wig out with the ridiculous amount of worms, his are not painfully taking over his body.
Thank goodness.
Phew. His are, in fact, giving him a long life. The worms are called B. arawakis, also sometimes referred to as the fountain of youth contagion. So this is why at the very beginning we learned that Will Henry was at least 120 when he died. They sit together by a fire, Dr. Warthrope burning the things left in his father's trunk. Will Henry has his little hat and another he found on his bedpost that morning, with his initials embroidered inside, nonchalantly given to him by the doctor.
Oh.
He tosses his little hat into the fire and puts the new one on his head.
In the epilogue, Rick Yancey returns to visit the facility where Will Henry was when he finally died. He explains that the folios are clearly fictional, but does he really believe that? Honestly? He asks about the autopsy to see if there was anything unusual in Will Henry's blood, but nothing was brought to anyone's attention, so there must not have been anything strange. Rick visits Will Henry's grave and sees a tiny worm, no bigger than a strand of hair, very similar to the worms the doctor described when examining Will Henry, and Will Henry described when talking about his father. Yeesh. Perhaps the whole story is true, and monsters are real after all. Of course monsters are real. I have one hanging in my basement. Snap to, Will Henry! You know what? I think we should take a moment, Claire.
Yes.
We should take a moment. And we should ask our audience. Please remember that Fictional Hangover is a free podcast and always will be. If you'd like to support the show, stop listening to us for just a few minutes, become a patron of ours on Patreon at patreon.com/fictionalhangover, then come back. If you can't do this monthly but still want to support us because you just like the show so much, head over to Ko-fi at ko-fi.com/fictionalhangover to drop us a one-time tip. Your support on Patreon and Ko-fi will help us bring you more spoiler-filled discussions, book character cosplays, and ridiculous content you know and love. Now, back to the episode.
Worms.
Worms!
Worms.
Worms everywhere! Worms. Snap
in
to, Will Henry!
Little hat.
There's worms! There's worms in your little hat, Will Henry! There's not worms in the hat. You know what? There probably are worms in the hat. I take it back. There's worms in the hat. Worm hat. I just love this story so much. I really, really do. It's so great.
Yes, it was really good. It was very atmospheric, wasn't it?
It was. It was indeed. You could just see it all.
Lit yes, it. Which is why it doesn't surprise me that I got optioned in 2018. I would love to see it, but at the same time, there's a lot of pus and a lot of worms. Do I want to see
and
that?
And a lot of maggots.
Lots of maggots.
Flies.
And chompy bellies.
Yes. Ugh. Chompy bellies. Dangling.
Dangling bits.
Dangling bits.
But do they have dangly boobs?
This is a question. This is a question that we
have. Let's discuss. So we have started this conversation. We had to stop ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We started this yesterday when we were talking about the anthropophagi and what they could possibly look like.
Yes, because they're described as, you know, being 6 to 8 feet tall. They don't have heads. They have giant eyes on their shoulders. They have a mouth that comes up like right under their rib cage. That's like a shark mouth. So it's full of teeth and huge. I can only imagine.
Yeah.
And then below that, I mean, they made some references throughout to there being males and females. And at one point when he's being attacked, Will Henry hits the anthropophagus in his pee-pee. They don't say it that way. They don't even mention it. But you know it's what happens. He got kicked in the balls. Okay? So we know they have these... They have ways to reproduce. And there's the mother, and she gives birth to the babies. But she can't keep the babies in a womb on account of the mouth belly. But this really makes us think, does she have bosoms? And do the bosoms of male or female anthropophagi, do they have nipples? They have testicles. They have penises. There's some sort of vagina situation on the females. Are there nipples? I don't know if they provide milk to their young, because their young eat their way out of corpses, and they are cannibals.
Exactly. There would have to be some sort of use, biological use for the nipple. I can't believe we're going to have such an in-depth conversation and quite a serious conversation about these fictional monsters having nipples. But let's go there. We have started on this wonderful path to Oz. Let's keep going to the Emerald City.
I don't know why this wouldn't be a conversation, because you've got to imagine these giant creatures. And there are illustrations from texts, because these are actual creatures that were described in Herodotus and in Shakespeare. They're actual monsters. So you gotta imagine what they look like.
I don't think there will have been bosoms as in what we would have them. They don't have the glands.
And
there.
Yeah.
Because they're not producing milk, because the babies don't need the milk.
Right.
Also, I almost get this kind of seahorses kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you know how the male seahorse will impregnate the female seahorse, but then the female seahorse gives it to the male to carry. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like that situation, except the male doesn't carry it, the male then takes it and puts it into, you know, alien style, puts it into a host.
Yes.
So you've kind of got the seahorse slash alien kind of without a face hugger.
Yeah.
Situation going on.
Yeah.
So there is a potential that there is a nipple, but I don't think there's going to be boobs, because boobs, there is the mammary glands, and if you don't need them, you won't have evolved with them.
Yeah.
So it could be a Ken doll, Barbie doll situation where it's flat.
Yeah. It would be dangerous, I think, to have a bosom, because then you're...
It would just keep going in your mouth.
Yeah, I mean, it's right like there. It's right
you
there.
You know when a hair gets into your mouth and you can't get it out yet?
Yeah, that would be what you were doing with your own
except
nipple.
It would be constantly with your boob.
Just get your and boob it's not out as of your if mouth.
Exactly. And if you throw it over your shoulder, where you're going to block your sight, because that's where your eyeball
is. Yeah, you can't do that. You'd have to, like, tuck them back and around. Tie them a little knot.
Try and tie them in a knot, but other that big and stretchy. And, you know, are you going to be able to wear a bra?
Well,
do you need
that
support, that posture support? Because the straps, unless you do strapless, are going to be right on the eyeballs again.
Yeah. You know?
And they are butt naked.
Yeah, I don't think they wear clothes. So I don't think a female anthropophagus would wear a brassiere.
No. I don't think they have boobs.
I don't think they do either.
I don't think they have a nipple either.
They probably don't have a nipple. There's not a whole lot of room for a nipple. And it's not like they can't, like, it's not like they were once human and they've evolved. Like, they're their own creature.
Exactly. Exactly.
Although, could you imagine the creatures that the elder Dr. Worthrop and his eugenics team wanted to create by chunking crazies into the hole? That's all the bones pile, by the way. That's where they dropped off the bodies, and then that's where they were eaten. But could you imagine what it would...
Trying to get the bump uglies.
Yeah.
No.
Did they, like, dress them up, you know, make them real fancy and put them in the hole, like we
give them a wash. You know what? The flat, if you take the head off and use just the shoulders, you know, you could have a nice hat.
Yeah.
Go down the ivy route from Gail Carriger's books.
Yeah.
Have a nice fancy hat.
Yeah.
A squish of perfume.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But no, then they would just eat them, so they did not.
They would just eat them.
They did not go on dates.
The thing is, though, they're trying to splice together two very different creatures. It's like you've got a cat and you've got a dog. They are not going to.
Yeah, they don't go together.
They don't go together. It's too early days. You need to go down to the DNA. You need to go down to the genetics. You know, and they are not scientifically advanced at this stage to be able to splice, do genetic splicing.
Yeah. So they...
So it's a little bit... I'm not going to say ahead of the time because it's still wrong.
Yeah.
but yeah, you cats and dogs living together in a world, it's crazy. It's crazy.
It is crazy. I have another question to ask you about tossing people down into the hole for the Anthropophagi guy to date.
Is it, would you?
Would you rather date an anthropologist or put your boob in your mouth? Would you rather... No. Do you think they were putting human females in the hole for the male Anthropophagi to impregnate? Or were they putting human males in the hole to impregnate the female Anthropophagi? And which one would be worse?
I do not think they discriminated.
They just throw them all in there?
Mm-hmm. Because you can't guarantee the male will definitely mate with the female, and vice versa, the female will definitely mate with the male. Also, as a human being thrown down the hole and being expected to
procreate,
mate, procreate, bump uglies with an anthropophagus, you're not going to be able, you're not going to be in the mood.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, no.
Mm-mm. Which is probably why they used people from the sanatorium. Because...
expendable.
Yeah.
But they're not.
Yeah.
They won't be missed.
No, and also they're crazy in some way, shape, or form. I mean, I would honestly throw that sleazy guy who was talking about being able to smell Will Henry, I'd throw him in the hole.
Oh, I'd throw him in the hole, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a bad person though. I probably have a list.
Yeah. That guy would be near the top though, if you're throwing in people from the sanatorium. Also the doctor and the nurse. They need to get pitched in the hole as well.
I will spatter them into that hole.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Except it would be like screaming, "This is your munchies."
Yes.
Enjoy.
Yes.
Indeed.
Oh my gosh. Do you know?
It's just nasty. Just the whole logistics of it. It's just nasty.
Yeah.
Just nasty.
But speaking of the sanatorium, can I just tell you that Dr. Varner's tail and subsequent foot removal and death was like my favorite part of the entire thing.
Really?
Yeah.
It was very emotive and smelly, that scene. Like, you could smell it.
Like,
and it was not
each
good.
Of the chapters have a quote from the chapter. And this one was called "What of the Flies?" Yeah, "What of the Flies, Dr. Warthrop?" Oh, yeah. "Maggots." Oh, yeah. "Bed sores." Oh, yeah. "Foot boot."
Ugh.
So good.
And then we were just screaming at him to "don't take my boots off."
Yeah.
"Don't take my boots off."
And you kind of think when he's saying that at first, like, these boots saved his life.
Yeah.
"Don't take the boots off."
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Exactly that.
Yeah. "Don't take my boots off." But oh yeah, "don't take my boots off because my foot's going to come off on the inside."
Yeah, I mean, even when they were peeling the blanket back, like, parts were coming off.
Yeah.
I can't. I mean, I'm saying you can imagine the smell, but you really, really, really can't.
Gotta be awful. And also because they covered it all with bleach. Like, it's just despicable.
I'm actually surprised that the captain lived that long.
Yeah.
In the conditions that he's in. I'm surprised that...
Yeah.
That he survived that length of time. Because... I wouldn't put the past them that they just never bothered feeding them. They obviously didn't clean them and move them around and give them any semblance of life.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised he even gave them basic food and water.
Ugh. No. Would not want to be there. No. I would not want to be in that sanitarium.
That sounds awful, but you kind of like, without the health and safety standards and the care and quality commissions that are in place at the moment, you know, that you kind of can't help but feel that's probably more standard of place some places.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't have had the facilities, the knowledge. It's, yeah. Times are different, thankfully.
Yeah. I also really liked James Henry's tale and his fiery murder-suicide.
Oh. I've got questions about James Henry.
Do you feel like James Henry and Dr. Worthrop had something going on the side?
Yes. That was going to be my question. Did you think that they had a relationship?
Yeah.
It builds in the story that Will Henry is getting more and more attached to Dr. Worthrop.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of you think, is this supposed to... To the degree that he would literally stand up and take a bullet for him, or, you know, he'd defend him against anything. And when he's given the option of, John Kearns to leave, he doesn't. He's mm-hmm. like, no, I need to stay and help him, protect him.
Yeah.
There's obviously some kind of, like, devotion to him because he's taken him in after his parents died. So there is some kind of, like, foster step relationship.
Yeah.
You know, he's a new father figure. But the way that James Henry and Dr. Worthrop's relationships described, and especially the arguments with Will Henry's mum,
mm.
made me think there is more to the relationship between James Henry and Dr. Worthrop.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that too from the very beginning. I mean, it was indispensable to him.
Do you think, I mean, we're reading a relationship into it, but at the same time, do you think there could be something that's happened in James Henry's past that Dr. Worthrop's been able to save him from or pull him from, and it's kind of like a life debt?
Could be. It's hard to say. We don't really know the history of James Henry and Dr. Worthrop.
No. And the thing, unless Worthrop tells us, or we read it in like one of his journal entries or something like that, we're never going to know.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've read the sequels. I can't quite remember anything of that nature being referenced. So
I think that kind of thing will probably stand out, and you know, for all the fact that it's been a while since you've read them, it feels like a piece of information that you would at least be able to have some semblance of recall of.
Yeah.
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 I thought my standout moments were the level of grossness. Like, last week when we talked about Horror Store,
mm-hmm.
and I'm like, what? And then I'm listening to the monstrologist, and I'm like, oh, puss in the mouth, oh, worms, oh, honestly. And the exploding tongue.
Yeah.
That was absolutely horrific. Horrific.
It's bad.
I both hate it and love it.
Yes.
It was so well done.
Yes. I love it. I love it so much. I have another question.
But I think... Oh, can I just say my favourite scene, though?
Yes, please.
My favourite scene was when Jack Kearns turns up and he gives about 60 million different names to the constable.
That was great.
I was in the car driving, actually. And... driving along and giggling away. I shouldn't be laughing at this book, but honestly, that had me tickled and I loved it.
Yeah. I just like that the constable went along with it. It's like, oh, yeah, his name is, you know, John Corey or whatever he said his name was. And he's like, oh, Corey. And then Dr. Warthrop comes up and he starts calling him Kearns. And he's like, what, Kearns? I thought it was Corey. He's like, oh, yeah, Corey's my Christian name. Or Corey was my name.
That's my middle name.
Yeah. Like,
that's the name that I was given at university by my paternity.
Yeah, it just... He just had something for every single name that was thrown at him. Like, oh, yes, this is my explanation for this name. So really, my entire name is 42 names long.
Yes, and I absolutely loved it.
And I
do not for one second believe that John Jack Kearns is his real name.
No, but the doctor doesn't believe it either.
No.
I really enjoyed that the constable was like, look, I don't care what your name is. It could be John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt. I don't care. And then later, when they go back to the sanatorium, he introduces himself as John J.J. Schmidt. And it's like, oh, he's, there he is. He's John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt.
It was just all delightful.
So great.
It
was so great.
It was that injection of humor that it was appropriate. It was really appropriate humor. And it was really, I loved it. I loved it.
I really liked how oblivious Dr. Warthrop was, too. There were so many times when he's having conversations with Will Henry and he's like, Will Henry, what are you doing? And Will Henry says, nothing. Oh, you're not doing anything? You're doing nothing? Well, I should give you something else to do because you're doing nothing. He's like, well, no, I'm not really doing nothing. Like, I'm going to cook breakfast. Breakfast? Who eats breakfast? Why are you making eggs? This is stupid. Like, just everything. He was so, like, dry and witty, but oblivious at the same time. What, you have a little hat? I've never seen you wear a little hat before, Will Henry. He's like, Doctor, I wear the little hat all the time. I wear it every day.
Like,
you're wearing a little hat? I've never seen you wear a little hat before. And then when he's so concerned about his little hat being at the cemetery, and he's like, I did not see any little hat at the cemetery. Why are you so obsessed with this little hat, Will Henry? And it's like, it was my father's. It was your father's hat? Why did you have your father's hat? No, my father gave me the hat. Why do you have your father's hat, Will Henry? Why is it so important to you? Like, just let him like his little hat, okay? It was so great.
It was brilliant. And Warthrop's, like, love for Will Henry as, like, an adopted son was so understated as well. It was really sweet.
Yeah.
That you had to, you know, when he's saying you're indispensable, that is, it's true.
Yeah.
What the hell is Warthrop's obsession with scones?
He loves them. You let him enjoy
his
scones.
Oh, he can have them. I'm happy for him to enjoy his scones. I just feel for Will Henry having to go to the market pretty much every single day to buy half a dozen scones to make sure they have a scone because it seems to be the only thing that Warthrop eats.
Yeah.
That is not nutritionally sound. Throw a fruit or a vegetable in there. I mean, having a cherry scone is still not one of your five a days, no matter how much I try to delude myself.
So I have a question. And
yes,
it occurred to me while we were doing the summary, the male anthropophagus that they
found.
We're
going to talk about their bits again.
No. The anthropophagus that was delivered at the beginning was approximately 25 to 30 years old. And we know that the ship's tale was from 23 years ago. So this is obviously the original male, right? Do you think that is...
Going by that logic.
Do you think that's why the female was so angry, like, coming at them because her mate is
gone. She lost her breeding partner.
Did she have another one?
Well, unless it's incest. Which...
It's gotta be.
It's gotta be.
There's too many.
The female anthropophagus is part batshit crazy psycho because we know this from the journal.
Yes.
And she's lost her breeding partner.
And her eyeball.
If the monogamous, like, completely mate for life, she's going to be well pissed.
Mm-hmm.
At the very least, she doesn't know what's happened to him.
Yeah.
And she's got a crap load of kids to look after.
Yeah.
That's going to make anybody crazy.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them down there.
Huge.
Yeah.
It's like a meerkat society, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and they just pop out of the ground and look around. Yeah,
look around. Make some angry noises.
Eat a corpse.
Back down. Eat a corpse.
Go back down into the hole.
They're like monstrous meerkats.
They are. They are indeed. And they can apparently swim. So maybe they're not a meerkat because they're swimming. Can meerkats swim?
I don't know how that works because the mouth, which you would assume is the breathing
area.
They're
doing the backstroke. They can see because their eyes are here. So they're backstroking.
Okay.
That's the only way they could swim. There's no other way.
And the forward-facing, so, like the Muppets.
They're predators.
You know they're hunters.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yep.
Do you know, I didn't enjoy quite so much about the book.
What?
Malachi.
Yeah, Malachi was a little whiny. He was a whiny bitch.
I mean, to be fair, he's got every right to have massive amounts of survivor guilt and to have a bit of a bitch and a moan. But as a character, I just like, oh, use him as bait, please.
Yeah, why'd they keep sacrificing Will Henry? Malachi was indispensable to no one.
Exactly.
And Will Henry is indispensable to the Doctor. I did like the shift. I'm not sure quite when it happened, but it did. It did shift from your services are indispensable to me to you are indispensable to me.
Yes.
At some point. So that was kind of delightful.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So Malachi was my least favourite character.
Yeah.
My favourite character, which I've pretty much already said, is John Jack Kearns or, you know, John J. Jingleheimer Schmidt.
Yes. Do you know?
He was an absolute bastard and I absolutely loved him.
He was delightful. I was surprised that John Jack Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt Corey Kearns was Jack the Ripper. I mean, it explains why he had a prostitute in a box.
Does it though? I mean, does not everybody in the Victorian era have a prostitute in a box?
I mean, they should.
Do you not have a prostitute in the box? What kind of monster hunter are you?
I'm apparently not a very good one because I am fresh out of boxed prostitute. But really, it explains so much. Like, why he was so flippant about death.
Yeah.
And, like, sacrificing Will Henry to the Anthropophagi. Like, he doesn't care. He's a murderer.
Right, okay, let's unpack the Jack the Ripper thing, okay?
Okay.
Let's go a little bit more. So, when the Jack the Ripper thing came up, I was like, oh, surprised. Same as you, surprised. But then I was kind of like, actually, that's probably about right. That feels right.
Yeah.
The chest, the really heavy wooden chest.
Mm-hmm.
I got strong Dracula vibes from that. Like, so you know how Dracula has the wooden box with his earth in it, the soil from the that was the vibes, and I was fully expecting them to open up that box and for it to have earth in it, and preferably it would be the earth with worms in it, because I was kind of like thinking, have they got the monster being the monster hunter? And yes, okay, in the literal sense, man is the greatest monster. Jack the Ripper was a monster. But I'm talking about, like, not an anthropophagi kind of monster, like, you know, your vampire kind, another variation of. So I wouldn't be surprised if John Kearns had a big coffin full of wormy soil that he kind of regenerated in.
Yeah. And, you know, he's got to bring it with him everywhere he goes.
Exactly. Dracula style.
Yeah.
Because even the ship scene was massive ode to Dracula.
Yeah. Yeah.
Except it didn't go to Whitby.
No. And then you think of Dracula dead and loving it.
Yeah,
running back and forth along the bottom of the ship trying to tie the coffin to the wall, but can't because it's a storm and it's rocking all over the place.
If the actors, if like Gene Wilder and if Leslie Nielsen was still alive, I would have adored them to do a spoof version of The Monstromologist.
Oh yeah, that would have been great.
That would have been delightful. If we can't get an accurate HBO nipple, no nipple.
Boob mouth,
puss-filled horror story of a show. I want that. Yeah.
Do you know, while reading it, even when I read it the first time, many, many years ago, I always envisioned Johnny Depp as his character in Sleepy Hollow, as Dr. Warthrop.
I can see it.
I can't think of anything else.
I can.
And he's
I
got his
want Johnny Depp to do it now. I've kind of moved on from the Johnny Depp.
But like the Sweeney Todd.
Yeah.
But that's what I think. That's who I picture.
Yeah, no, it. I can see that. I can see that.
And you know, especially in Sleepy Hollow, he's got his little, his young little assistant that he's picked up because his parents are dead. It's a perfect Dr. Warthrop and Will Henry.
It would have to be one of the Stranger Things kids now, wouldn't it?
No, because now they're even older. Nose?
Oh god, yeah, they're like 60 now, aren't they?
I'm kind of thinking it, the new version. You know the little boy who was Georgie? I could imagine him. He was also in Lock and Key. I could imagine him as being a little Will Henry. Because he's...
I thought he was the one in Stranger Things.
No, I don't think so. He's too small for that.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of a different kid. Sorry, yes, no, yeah. I agree. Who would I want to be? John Kearns.
You mentioned James McAvoy when we were talking
about I
just want James McAvoy to be everything. But he would be a good Kearns. He's good at...
I'm tossing and turning between him and Eddie Redmayne.
Yeah. Okay. I just like Eddie Redmayne.
I just like Eddie Redmayne. But I could see either of them doing that kind of... You know, the quick... comedy scenes of the names, but then being able to turn on a dime and be an absolute
I'm here for it. Okay, finally, is it time?
It's time.
It is time.
Would you rather?
So what's our first question?
So on social media, you need to join our Facebook group. It's the Fictional Hangover Would You Rather group. You need to join. It's an automatic joining. We won't ask you any questions to join it. It's a public group. The only things you will ever see on that group are Would You Rather questions. We are going to ask historical questions. Mm-hmm. Some of our favourites we'll start off with, and then we'll just throw in some others that listeners particularly like. So we will throw some archive Would You Rather questions in, but that's where we're going to be posting our new Would You Rather questions as well. We'll always pin it to the top. We will share it to the Facebook Fictional Hangover page, but the only way you can vote is by joining the group. So please, if you want to comment, please also vote. Join the group and vote. You are not going to be spammed on that group at all.
All it is Would You Rather questions.
Exactly. It's just Would You Rather. It's our workaround on Facebook, because Facebook are a pain in the butt and they took away our polling option on the Facebook Fictional Hangover page. So we've had to create a group. So please, please, please join the group. Answer the question and leave a comment. You can still comment on the Fictional Hangover page itself.
Mm-hmm.
It would be great if you joined the Fictional Hangover Would You Rather group too.
Yes. But also,
have some fun with the old ones.
Yeah, really. The old ones are spectacular. But failing that whole Facebook fiasco, we do also still have the Would You Rather polls posted on Instagram and on Twitter.
Yes. On Instagram, it is the Instagram stories. It is only there for a very short period of time. And it is posted on a Sunday. But if you comment, we will take it on board when you comment on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And on Twitter, it's there for 3 days. So this week we asked you, Would you rather be lost in an underground tunnel system in the pitch black darkness? Oh, and also there's monsters. Or be on a ship out at sea in a storm? Oh, and there's also monsters.
Monsters all over the place.
On Facebook, 57% of you said the underground tunnel system and 43% said their ship. On Instagram, it was 24% the underground tunnel system and 76% said the ship. And on Twitter, straight up 50-50. Thanks, Twitter. We can rely on you.
Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
And we had some absolutely magnificent comments for this one.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. So, Melissa on Facebook said, underground tunnel system. If you can beat / escape the monsters in the tunnel system, you don't have to worry about anything else. Maybe. But on a ship out at sea in a storm, sharks and or the Kraken could be waiting for that ship to capsize. Do you even know how to sail in a storm? So many other obstacles to get to safety versus the underground tunnels. It's good reasoning.
I mean, she's obviously done a risk assessment then.
Yes. I mean, and I would not be surprised that a Kraken would exist in this world.
Oh no. There's going to be leviathans of the sea all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah.
On Facebook, Colin said, I'll take the underground tunnels, thank you very much. At least there is an illusion on control in that scenario. Being stuck on a ship in a storm feels like you're at the mercy of the gods, and I'm pretty sure I pissed that lot off ages ago. Oops.
Whoops.
Poseidon done you wrong.
Superfan Constance on Facebook said, I'll take the ship in a storm. Storms make me sleepy. I'll go below deck and pass the yuck out. Can't be afraid if you're passed out asleep. We're just kind
Do
of
we have to go back to Ruth Ann in Horror Store. If you can't see me, I can't see you.
And that's your eyeballs popped out.
With your bone fingers.
Yep.
Nina on Facebook said, on a ship because A, claustrophobia. B, on a vast expanse of ocean, I'd hope for the smaller chance of being found / attacked.
Candy on Facebook said, I have a severe fear of drowning, but I think I'd rather see what's coming. And like Casey said, which we'll get to that one in a second, and like Casey said, there are more than likely lifeboats and jackets on said ship. So at least I'd have a fighting chance. And let's go to see what Casey said. I would choose the ship because at least most ships have lifeboats and there would be some chance of escape. Plus, I'm afraid of the dark, so tunnels are a no-go. They've teamed up, Candy and Casey.
Yeah. Ashley on Facebook said, I'd rather be underground with the monsters. I have a deep-seated thalassophobia. While I'm also afraid of the dark, at least I wouldn't be near Cthulhu or dragged underwater.
Mm. Cthulhu versus the Kraken.
Only on pay-per-view. Friday.
Finally, Coral on Facebook said, out on a ship, there's really nowhere to go but in the sea. In a tunnel, you might be able to get out. Maybe. This is true. You know, you're surrounded by water. What are you going to do once you are able to escape, besides get attacked by the Kraken?
Yeah. But if you're in a pitch black tunnel, you need to find your way out.
Yeah, but once you find your way out, I mean, you could go anywhere. Then you could get on a ship in the sea once you escape.
And then be attacked by Cthulhu. So what are you doing? Are you in the tunnel or are you in the sea? Get in the sea!
I think I'm going to go with the tunnels.
Okay. Do you not remember our Divinus episode?
I remember really enjoying dressing up for that
you
layer
like
of dreams. Yes, I really liked wearing those teeth and spitting them out and drooling all over myself.
It's one of our favorite cosplays you've done.
I really enjoyed it. So I think, though, that I would go with the tunnels because I feel like there's more of them. There's more space. You could hide more easily. And it's pitch black. And we know the Anthropophagi have eyes. So clearly, you know, they do use their eyes to see things. But if you're in the pitch black darkness, you know, maybe it would be easier to hide. And you could get out. Or maybe you could tunnel out, start digging, use a bone, dig your way out.
Mm-hmm.
And also the whole, if you can't see them, they can't see you thing. And then your eyeballs pop out with your bone fingers. Again.
I have too many questions about the tunnel. One, what's it made of? Two, how big is it? Three, are there places to hide, or is it just a tunnel?
I would like to think that it's the same underground tunnel system under the cemetery where our doctor and Will Henry were.
But then,
a labyrinthine
tunnel system. Yes, but that tunnel system has been made by the monsters. They know that system. And also, yeah, they've got eyeballs, but I've got a feeling they can see pretty well in the dark.
They probably can. They do have giant eyeballs.
Exactly. I would go with the sea. I would, at least I'll have the option of being able to see in the sea. but I have a defense mechanism. It's called seasickness.
Mm.
So I'll just be like vomiting all over.
Yes. Okay.
But also lifeboats. I would take my chance on a lifeboat. And that's what happened in the book. He survived. He took a chance on a lifeboat.
Yeah.
I mean, he did become an obese, bedridden, crazy person in the sanatorium that dies a horrific, horrific, painful death. But he survived.
Yeah.
So I'm going to head straight. You know, as I ain't waiting around. I'm getting straight on the lifeboat. Screw everybody else. Me and my loved ones are gone.
Okay. Okay. Next question. Would you rather get bitten by an anthropophagus or bite into an anthropophagus's pus-filled wound?
Gross, gross, gross. Am I going to survive the bite?
Sure.
I'll go with the bite. And hope it's on, like, my arm or something, or, like, leg and not a vital organ.
Yeah.
I don't... Ugh.
That's like a shark bite, though.
People survive shark bites. I've got Western medicine. Modern day medicine, and patch me back up. Because the idea of the pus filled wound in my mouth, for all the fact it would be a very short period of time, and I would just basically vom everywhere.
Mm-hmm. You were already vomiting earlier, why not just vomit now?
That's seasickness, it's different.
It's not pus sickness, pus. It's seasickness.
And the ones if you swallowed some of it. You know, you're gasping for air and... I'm going to go with bitten from by the anthropophagus. I don't want to be bitten by one.
This is a terrible question.
That's because you're a terrible person.
I know. I'm well aware of that.
You like this. You take great joy in posing these questions.
I do.
Now answer the question.
I think I'm going to bite him. I think I'm going to bite him.
You like pus.
I don't like pus, but I think I'm going to bite him. I'm going to bite him. I'm going to barf. I'm going to run. I'll go drink some of that dirty river water. Wash my mouth out.
Cholera is better than the pus in your mouth.
Yeah, I'm going to bite him. I'm going to bite him. I'm going to do it. I'm going to bite him.
See, I like to think at least if you're being bitten by the anthropophagus, you're kind of like fighting back. So there's a good chance that you'll... I don't know.
You're also fighting him if you're biting him. Fight bite.
It's not as if I've got hair you can pull and have a proper cat fight, is it?
We don't know. This goes back to the Ken situation. Is he a smooth... like hairless creature? Do they have, you know, they have a great big hairy back or hair in their bathing suit area? Would you pull that hair?
Cow eyelashes.
They might have eyelashes.
Really long ones. And then curl them.
Do they have
themselves pretty?
They don't have eyelids, do they? They have, like, the film.
Like a membrane.
Yeah. So maybe they don't have eyelashes. You cannot put mascara on an anthropophagus.
But that's just distressing.
That would...
Put eyeliner on them.
You could put eyeliner on them. But, you know, if you don't have, like, the mascara-eyeliner combination, and then you're trying to get them to successfully mate, I mean, I feel like you need the eyeliner and mascara.
I think you would go through a lot of lipstick and lip gloss with them. With their giant belly mouths.
Yeah. Yeah, you would.
And then if they grew a beard, is it beard hair or is it pubes?
It's pube hair.
Hmm.
It's very coarse, curly hair.
Tight.
Yep.
Not a question. And you know who will be answering these questions? Would you rather be a monster scientist? Find out the answer to these very in-depth questions we have about anthropomorphic biology and anatomy. Or would you rather be a monster hunter and just kill the monster people, things?
I kind of like the idea of studying them.
Yeah. Because then I will be able to find out the answer to all of our questions.
Right. And we have so many questions.
So many.
And I feel like we both need to learn the answers.
Like, if their mouths are there, how do their, like... are the lungs further up? That would be putting them near the eyeballs?
Their lungs I would say they're behind the rib cage. And the mouth is underneath the rib cage. So I think,
because where's their stomach?
I would say it's probably behind their mouth. You know, and like on the back side.
So it's not really kind of like... Do they have a saggy bum then? They have big bums. And it's not fat. It's like...
It's more organs.
Bowel system.
Could be.
So many questions.
So many questions.
That can only be answered by being a monster scientist.
We need to be monster scientists.
There we go. There we go. Let's move on.
Would you rather be Captain Varner with his flies and maggots or James Henry with his Arawakus worms?
This is one of the worst questions.
Is it worse than the pus?
Yes.
Which one are you going to be? You're not going to survive either way. You do not have Will Henry's version of the worms that give you everlasting life. You got the bad ones.
Well, shit.
Flies or worms?
I'm possibly thinking James Henry, because he had the Arawakus worms for a short period of time. They kind of took over his body fairly quickly,
mm-hmm.
and he went crazy,
and I would kind of in the flames.
I would kind of hope that I would recess and remove myself mentally from what's going on, and then I would still have potentially some ability to just end it. I don't know how. You're just a giant shell full of worms, aren't you, at this point? Nothing is you. You've lost you. You are the worm host. Whereas Captain Varner was stuck for at least 20 years in the sanatorium, wearing the same pair of boots and slowly dying, being filled with maggots and flies and the smell.
Yeah.
At least I feel like with James Henry it would be a shorter period of time, and I could just go crazy and remove myself mentally from the situation.
Yeah, I think the whole being bedridden part of Captain Varner with his flies and maggots, I don't want to be bedridden. I want to still be able to get up and walk around. So if I'm getting up and walking around and I'm full of worms, that's better than being bedridden. So I'm going to go with James Henry and his Arawakus worms.
It's a horrible question. It's one of the worst questions.
It is. It is one of the worst questions that I think we've ever asked on the show.
Okay, moving on.
Yep.
Would you rather pull off your foot or pulling off your boot? Captain Varna style. Or be an incubator for a baby anthropophagus. Again, this is a horrible question. October is the month for horrible would you rather questions. I'm tempted to put these ones up in the would you rather group. Because they're that horrible.
Yeah.
These are our October specials.
But see, a lot of them, though, you have to have read the book to understand.
Yeah.
How long am I going to survive after I pull off my own foot? Is it the same Captain Varna situation where once my foot is pulled off, I'm going to die shortly thereafter?
Well, your body's going to go in shock.
Also, question. Am I already dead if I'm incubating a baby anthropophagus?
Hmm.
Am I a corpse?
It was a corpse, wasn't it?
If I'm a corpse already, then I might as well just already be a corpse. Shove all the babies in that you want.
Or, what if we said it was aliens style? It's the face hugging without the face hugger.
That could also be bad. And it just bursts out.
Eats its way out. What was if it ate its way out? And then you look down and it's the Renesmee doll.
Oh, that's even worse. Especially if it's the robot. The disused robot. Renesmee doll. It's terrible.
Mama!
I think I'm going to be the incubator.
Live or corpse?
I mean, if I get to choose, I'm going to be a corpse.
Yeah. I can't imagine with the foot thing being pulled off and you're in Captain Varna's situation, you're already half dead. You're already decomposing. He was decomposing.
Yeah.
And that was the final straw.
Yeah.
And the way I understood the baby incubator, it was a corpse from the graveyard.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll join you and be the incubator.
Okay.
As a corpse.
Normally, this would be the end of Would You Rather, but I have another question for you. Would you rather snap to Will Henry or snap to Will Henry?
I will take snap to Will Henry.
Very good. Me too.
Excellent.
Just had to say something.
You are now indispensable to me.
Aw, you're indispensable to me.
Aw. Oh my god, that was gross. And do you know what? It's horrible. I just think about the Monstromologist and I think about all those gross, horrible, disgusting scenes and I get a bad smell. I mean, I've got a terrible sense of smell, but it's like I have these... That sense kind of goes, ooh, no.
Ooh.
And then to try and go and answer the would you rather questions and it's all pus filled and...
Maggoty and...
Feet off and...
Wormy. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just gross.
Yeah. Quite enjoyable, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. That's the end of Would You Rather. Thank goodness. It's over. Finally.
Survived that one.
Yes.
Got a baby anthropomorphous inside me, but I've survived.
You've survived for now. So now, it's time for favorite final thought quote. Do you have one? Do you have one that is perhaps one for fun?
I have a one for fun. I know exactly what your favourite quote is because you've been saying it all day, but I'm gonna let you get to it.
Okay.
Yes, my dear child, monsters are real. I happen to have one hanging in my basement.
I love it.
I just found that hilarious.
Yep.
Come see my monster in the basement.
Here he is. He's dangling.
He's just dangling there. Poke it if you wanna.
Very good. Oh, that reminds me of Will Henry having to go down into the basement to retrieve the trunk, and he's terrified because he thinks that the corpse anthropophagus is going to have another baby hidden inside of him that the doctor didn't find, and then he thinks that there's going to be a scrabbling baby around all over the place. Forgot about that scene. That was a good scene.
That's a justifiable fear as well, to be fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, my bit more serious quote is, there are times when fear is not our enemy. There are times when fear is our truest, sometimes only friend. And I like this because, especially in the current world situation, there's so much that you can't control,
mm-hmm.
and there's so much fear, and it's kind of like you need to take it and you need to mold it into something that you can use.
Yeah.
Even if it's just making yourself a bit more self-aware and responsible, or doing some research into like a political candidate or something like that. It's just, you know, that's looking at science rather than supposition.
Mm-hmm.
It's a useful tool if you can take it and use it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay, what about you? Do you have a one for fun, and do you have a serious one? And you can go in either order.
Of course I have a one for fun. And of course I have a regular one. And everyone knows the one for fun is snap to Will Henry.
You're no killer.
You're no killer. Snap to Will Henry. Yeah. You gotta say snap to.
It was just brilliant.
You gotta snap to Will Henry. I like throughout, you know, this is said all throughout the entire novel. And there were a couple of times where he didn't put enough snap in his two or whatever. So it wasn't just snap to Will Henry. There was more to it sometimes.
Yeah, I was surprised. When we look at the quotes, I always like to make sure I've got it right, so I'll check on Tinternet Web. And I was surprised when I was having a look through Goodreads, Snap to Will Henry wasn't one of the suggested quotes from the book. I'm like, it's a classic!
It's classic. It's fantastic. But I also have another one.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know why our race is doomed, Pelinor? Because it has fallen in love with the pleasant fiction that we are somehow above the very rules that we have determined to govern everything else.
Again.
Again.
Massively, hugely appropriate.
Yes, indeed.
Dang.
I know. I know. Go vote, everyone. Go vote. Always vote. Even if you're not listening to this as soon as the episode comes out, always vote. It's important. Okay. If you liked this, try this. What have you got?
Ooh. Okay, I am going to recommend A Taste for Monsters by Matthew J. Kirby. I am currently listening to this one.
Hmm.
Hmm. Okay, so summary as per Goodreads. It's London, 1888, and Jack the Ripper is terrorising the people of the city. Evelyn, a young woman disfigured by her dangerous work in a matchstick factory, who has nowhere to go, does not know what to make of her new position as the maid to the Elephant Man in London Hospital. Evelyn wants to be locked away from the world, like he is, shut from the filth and dangers of the street. But in Joseph Merrick, the Elephant Man, she finds a gentle kindred who does not recoil from her and who understands her pain. When the murders begin, however, Joseph and Evelyn are haunted nightly by the ghosts of the Ripper's dead, setting Evelyn on a path to facing her fears and uncovering humanity's worst nightmares.
Ooh.
I am currently listening to this one, and it's really, really good. I'm listening to the audiobook, and I cannot remember the name of the narrator at the moment, but she is very, very good. She is very, very good. And there are scenes which, I mean, obviously there's the Jack the Ripper link with, you know, John Kern,
mm-hmm.
but the scenes where, again, it's the smell.
Mm.
And that very much reminded me of the Monstromologist. And again, the girl, or the younger person being brought into a situation against, you know, out of necessity and need.
Mm-hmm.
She literally has nowhere else to go. And the next level down is to, you know, go into a line of work she does want to enter. And it was just those themes, rather than the Jack the Ripper thing, it was those kind of tropes, those themes that were in the Monstromologist. That reminds me of The Taste for Monsters. It's really, really good so far. Really, really good.
Good. Good. I like it.
What about you? What would you recommend?
Well, I just read something today, as a matter of fact. But now I've just recently been inspired by something else, so I think I'm going to have two recommendations this time. And so, yeah. The first that I would like to suggest is, again, something not typical for me to suggest. Like, last week I suggested a podcast. This time I'm suggesting a graphic novel. It's called Through the Woods by Emily Carroll. It came from the woods. Most strange things do. Five mysterious, spine-tingling stories follow journeys into and out of the eerie abyss. These chilling tales spring from the macabre imagination of acclaimed and award-winning comic creator Emily Carroll. Come, take a walk in the woods and see what awaits you there. So this is very, like, gothic, Victorian, creepily illustrated horror stories. It's pretty brief, but the illustrations are top-notch.
I adore horror graphic novels. I adore them. They are so evocative. They're like, they're amazing. They're so well done.
Yeah. So I would check that one out if I were you. The illustrations are fantastic.
As she quickly reaches for her phone to bookmark.
Yeah. So the other one that I thought of is, it's part two in a series, but they're all kind of standalone-ish tales. They do all tie together, but this is part two in the Wayward Children series by Shannon Maguire.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Down Among the Sticks and Bones. And the summary, as per Goodreads. Twin sisters, Jack and Jill, were 17 when they found their way home and were packed off to Eleanor West's home for wayward children. This is the story of what happened first. Jacqueline was her mother's perfect daughter, polite and quiet, always dressed as a princess. If her mother was sometimes a little strict, it's because crafting the perfect daughter takes discipline. Jillian was her father's perfect daughter, adventurous, thrill-seeking, and a bit of a tomboy. He really would have preferred a son, but you work with what you've got. They were five when they learned that grown-ups can't be trusted. They were 12 when they walked down the impossible staircase and discovered that the pretense of love can never be enough to prepare you for a life filled with magic in a land filled with mad scientists and death and choices. So this one is a little Frankenstein-y.
Mm.
Very good, though. As are all the rest of the Wayward Children books. They're also very short. That one's only 187 pages. But they're great stories. I would suggest reading all of the Wayward Children books.
Ooh. Emily Carroll has another graphic novel out called When I Arrived at the Castle. Like many before her that have never come back, she's made it out to the Countess's castle, determined to snuff out the horror. But she could never be prepared for what hides within its turrets, what unfurls under its fluttering flags. Emily Carroll has fashioned a rich gothic horror charged with eroticism that doesn't make your skin crawl, it crawls into it.
Ooh, excellent. Ooh. Yeah. All right. Well, that's it for this episode of Fictional Hangover. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Claire.
Join us next time as we discuss Clown in a Cornfield by Adam Caesar, narrated by our favorite, Jesse Valinsky.
Yay!
Look out for the Would You Rather poll to go along with that book on social media. Don't forget about our book club and monthly challenges on Facebook. Be sure to visit our shop on Redbubble at fictionalhangover.redbubble.com for all your favorite Fictional Hangover-themed merchandise. And now, become a patron of ours on Patreon at patreon.com/fictionalhangover or support us on Ko-fi at ko-fi.com/fictionalhangover. Until next time, remember, the only cure for a fictional hangover is another book.
can find us at fictionalhangover.com, follow us on Instagram at fictionalhangover, find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fictionalhangover, and on Twitter at fictionalhangover, no ER. If you'd like this episode, check out our others and rate, review and subscribe so you don't miss out. And finally, special thanks to Liz Emerson for our music. You can find her on Facebook and Patreon. Thanks for listening.